The Senate will please come to order, and the clerk will please call the roll.
Atkinson, Bates, Bates, Beyer, Boquist, Boquist, Burdick, Burdick, Devlin, Devlin, Dingfelder, Dingfelder, Edwards, Edwards, Ferrioli, George, George, Gerard, Haas, Haas, Johnson, Johnson, Cruz, Cruz, Montes Anderson, Monroe, Monroe, Morris, Nelson, Olson, Przanski, Przanski, Rosenbaum, Shields, Shields, Starr, Steiner Hayward, Telfer, Thompson, Thompson, Berger, Whitsitt, Winters, President Courtney.
A quorum being present, we will post the colors, and Senator Doug Whitsitt will lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance. Senator David Nelson will deliver today's invocation.
Thank you, Mr. President. This invocation today is taken from a Lenten evening song. It's a group of churches in Pendleton, Peace Lutheran Church, First United Methodist Church, and Redeemer Episcopal Church. Let us pray. God of mercy, hold us in love. In peace, we pray to you. For peace and salvation, we pray to you. For peace between nations, for peace between peoples. For we who are gathered to worship and praise you. And for all your servants. And for all those who govern, that justice might guide them. And for all those who labor in service to others. And grant us that weather and conditions will nourish all of creation. And keep watch on our loved ones and keep us from danger. For all the beloved who rest in our mercy. Amen. Thank you.
Senator Nelson, for your invocation. Thank you, Senator Whitsitt, for leading us in Pledge of Allegiance. We're now on a courtesies. Recognize Senator Lori Montes Anderson, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'd like courtesies extended to my interim February legislative assistant, Jesse O'Brien. He grew up in Forest Grove, went to Swarthmore College, got his degree in philosophy, and then a master's in social work at Portland State. And he loves hiking and reading. Of course, he's a philosopher. He loves reading and long-distance running. Thank you, Mr. President, in extending courtesies to Jesse O'Brien.
Thank you, Jesse. Thank you for being here, and keep on running. Keep on running. Just keep on running. We're pleased you could be here. It's an honor and privilege, and I'd like to extend the courtesy of the Senate to you. Thank you very much. Recognize Senator Frank Morris.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would ask that you extend courtesies to our good friend, my very good friend, Ed Wright, who has come back for this very short session to help 2 days a week in our office. And he's doing this on his ticket because he wants to be here, Mr. President. So welcome Ed back, if you would, please.
It's a high honor. I know Ed Wright. He's a great human being, and I know that Ed Wright and Frank Morris are actually brothers. They're not really brothers, but they are brothers, and I think they feel that way about each other. Ed's a wonderful human being, a great person. He's carrying a personal cross in itself, doing it in such an extraordinary way. So, Ed, I'm glad you came back. However you came back, whatever brings you back, I just think you always just keep coming back, Ed. So nice to see you. I'd like to extend the courtesy of the Senate to you. I recognize Senator Chuck Thompson, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. It's Valentine's Day today, and I'd like you to do me a great big favor. I'm not able to be with my spouse of 30 years today because we're doing the state's good work, and I'd like to, for you to please extend courtesies and lots of love to my wife, Christy, and all the spouses and significant others that the rest of us can't be with today. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Senator Chuck Thompson came to me yesterday and asked permission from Secretary of State if he could extend a personal happy Valentine's Day to all the mates, husbands, and wives, and significant others in our lives. I thought it was a very beautiful gesture. I'm not going to send your wife my personal love. I'm not sure how well that would go over. But, I mean, it's a nice gesture. No, it makes my heart sing when you did it. So thank you, because to my wife, Margie, to any significant person in your life, anybody you love, that special person, I, on behalf of all of you, wish them all, wherever they may be, happy Valentine's Day, and I hope that that's what you want. It's a very nice gesture. That was just sweet of you to do that, and I hope you'll explain to your wife about myself and my love for her, if you would, please. Thank you. I recognize Senator Floyd Pazansky, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I also ask that you extend courtesies to a constituent, Bonnie Chalmers. She's here today with a group of foreign students from representing Norway and Kyrgyzstan. This is under a FLEX program for high school students to allow these students to come over to the United States and experience our part of the world. So thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you. I didn't quite get all the names, but I know I heard Norway. My wife, all her relatives are from Norway. I got to get to Norway one day, so I wish she could be here. She's from the area of Bodø. You probably never heard of Bodø, Norway, but it's way up north. So to all the Norwegians that are here, whether you're from there or not, to all of you, we're happy you're here. Thank you, Senator Floyd Pazansky. Wish you a happy Valentine's Day. Stay as long as you like. Oregon is honored by your presence. Recognize Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Mr. President. Please extend courtesies of the Senate to Michelle Kennedy. Michelle joined our team. We offered her a job on the Monday of Martin Luther King Day, and she showed up at work at 8 o'clock on Tuesday morning to help get me started. She was previously a legislative assistant for Representative David Edwards for several sessions and really helped him run smoothly. In the interim between working with Representative Edwards and working with Gail Snyder, our other team member, and me, she taught English in Morocco for several months, where her niece and her family live. And without Michelle, I can guarantee you that I would have been at best 25% functional this session. So I owe her an enormous debt of gratitude, and I'm grateful to you for extending the courtesies of the Senate.
So, Michelle, thank you. I'm glad for being here. I'd like to extend the courtesies to Senator. Thank you for making Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward whole as opposed to just part of whole. So stay as long as you like, and we all need great staff, and it sounds like she's found that in you. So thank you very much for being here. I recognize Senator Chuck Thompson again. I'm coming to you, Senator Johnson, but I want to go last, if you know what I mean. So I'm not ignoring you, Senator Johnson. So you want to do it again, Senator Johnson. You have someone you want to personally tell us to say hello to, Senator Chuck Thompson. Yes, please.
Yes, Mr. President. Please extend courtesies to a friend of mine from back home, Jim Slusher. He's been the executive director the past 30 years for Mid-Columbia Action Council, whose mission is to eliminate poverty in the counties of Hood River, Wasco, and Sherman counties, and as a commissioner, I served on his board for a couple of years. Jim is a fourth-generation Oregonian and is related to Mr. Dufer. His mother, Gloria, was Oregon's first female trooper. And Jim also, I hate to admit this, but helped support himself by taking my money on the golf course. Thank you for extending courtesies, Mr. President.
Thank you. Jim, thanks for being here, and appreciate the – it's an honor and privilege to have you here. Stay as long as you like, and I'm happy you've been successful on the golf course. I don't play golf, and you can take my money anytime even before I got on the golf course. So thank you. Have a good day. Recognize Senator Alan Bates.
Thank you, Mr. President. As some of our colleagues in the House last night had the opportunity to see me in total surprise and shock when a woman walked up behind me, kissed me on the top of my head, and put her arms around me. I jumped up thinking that I was in big trouble because I'm a married man, turned around and found it was my wonderful wife, Lori, who came up last night to surprise me. Please give her due response to never doing that to me again. It was very embarrassing. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I'd like to send a courtesy to Senator Lori. I saw Lori earlier today. She brings out the best in Senator Alan Bates, and he didn't do it, but I will. Happy Valentine's Day, Lori. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Are there any other courtesies? Okay. As you all know, my fellow senators, today is Oregon's 153rd birthday. Over those years, Oregon has received many blessings. So it is fitting that today, on Oregon's birthday, we pause to recognize the blessings to our state. That is Mark Odom Hatfield. We all know his achievements, and our state is a better place thanks to Senator Hatfield's years of public service. We're very fortunate that Senator Hatfield gave so much of himself to the service of the great state of Oregon. And so today, the Oregon Senate says thank you to Senator Hatfield on behalf of a grateful state and her wonderful people. We also must say thank you, though, to Senator Hatfield's family and friends. They, too, sacrificed for our state by supporting the senator as he supported all of us. And so to them, we also owe a debt of extraordinary gratitude. With that saying, I now want to call on Senator Betsy Johnson for courtesy, and I do not know whether Senator Jason Atkinson will follow, but now I recognize Senator Betsy Johnson.
Mr. President, on behalf of the Senate, I would respectfully ask that you extend courtesies to Mr. Jerry Frank, seated here at my desk, an Oregon icon in his own right. Mr. Frank is the fourth generation of the family that founded Myron Franks in 1857. He's a columnist for the Oregonian. He was Senator Hatfield's longtime chief of staff, friend, confidant, trusted advisor for 50 years. He is a chocolate cake connoisseur, an author, and Mr. Salem. There is nothing in this town of good that happens without Jerry Frank's fingerprints all over it. Mr. President, would you please extend the courtesies of the Senate to Jerry Frank?
It's truly my privilege to extend the courtesy of the Senate to Jerry Frank. I have known Mr. Frank for many years. Some of my weight is due to Senator Frank because of the Candida eye, but also I'm aware of him. I was aware of him long before I met him because of the way he dealt with people as a human being with his remarkable, successful, the Frank store here and just his charitable work. He has an extraordinary touch. You know, he's always called Salem his home, even though he's a citizen of the entire world. China, New York City. And so I'm really pleased that you've just done what you've done, Johnson, Senator Johnson, to let us say thank you as well to Jerry Frank, who is, if you will, a brother to Mark Hatfield. It was Jerry Frank who put together the memorial service, extraordinary memorial service for Senator Mark Hatfield. So I see them as brothers. And so, Jerry, thank you for being here. It's an extraordinary honor and privilege. You honor us just by being on the Senate floor here today. So, yes, I extend the courtesies of the Senate to you on Oregon's birthday. I just wish your brother could be here with you. Thank you very much for being here. Recognize Senator Jason Atkinson.
Mr. President, I too would like to extend courtesies similar to what you have said earlier, but as I look around the gallery with us today, and I know watching online, are generations of people who worked in the senator's office. And this morning, as I was in preparation for some remarks I'll give here shortly with Senator Johnson, someone came to me and told me that they never knew Senator Hatfield, but they knew that his staffers were the best of the best, and that anyone that had ever worked in a Hatfield office was known as someone who kept their word, was respectful, loved the institution, and they were the best of the best. And the person who told me that said that some of those people are around this building today. Some of them are serving in the other house. Some of them have served before. So, Mr. President, on behalf of that reputation, I would ask you to extend courtesies to the senators, staffers who are watching and are here today.
Thank you, IU. I can't add too much to the words, the eloquent words of Senator Jason Atkinson, to all the family and friends that are gathered here today. As you might know, on the Memorial Service Day, your Oregon State Senate played a special role. Where Senator Doug Whitsitt is now sitting, the chamber was blacked out, and there was a single spotlight on a red rose where Senator Doug Whitsitt is sitting, because that is where Senator Mark Hatfield sat. In addition, a remarkable few words that had been uttered by the great senator were posted on both boards over here, and that was what your Senate showed, his writings in that simple rose. The House chamber was jam-packed. It was remarkable service, but the simplicity and the power and the dignity of this chamber was referred to over and over that day. And so everything that Senator Atkinson said reflects this body, this chamber, and I'm so pleased to the family and friends that you could be here today as we're about to pay literally the highest tribute the Oregon State Senate can pay to one of Oregon's greatest citizens. So thank you, Senator Atkinson. We extend the official courtesies of this day, Oregon's birthday, to each and every one of you. Thank you. I am now going to close courtesies, and I'm going to move to remonstrances. Excuse me, recognize Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. President. What a pleasure it is to be here today, February 14th, 163 years after our state was brought into the Union. If I could direct my colleagues' attention to the mural at the front, you'll see a young man with a brown hat in his back to us, and he's pointing upward. And through historical discovery and talking to many learned scholars, I have found out that young man is saying, "Hey, mister, it's Tuesday. Everybody should have a job on Tuesday."
Messages from the House.
Mr. President, I'm directed by the co-speakers to inform you the House has passed House Bill 4013, 4015, 4035, 4046, 4068, and 4092.
Reports from committees. In accordance with SR 8.551, committee report summary number 15 was distributed to members February 13th, and number 16 was distributed today. This information will be recorded in the Journal of the State's report and is so ordered. We're now on a propositions of motion. Recognize Senator Dianne Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that consideration of SCR 202 be taken from its place on today's third reading calendar and be made a special order of business immediately.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved the consideration of SCR 202 be taken from its place on today's third reading calendar and be made a special order of business immediately. To your motion.
Thank you, colleagues. As you have already heard, this resolution is particularly appropriate today. Many, many friends and family and esteemed guests have come to hear us consider and honor Mark Hatfield, and I recommend that we do so immediately.
We're now on to discussion of the motion. If there's no further discussion, Senator Rosenbaum, do you wish to close? She says not. The question is on taking SCR 202 from today's third reading calendar and making it a special order of business immediately. Those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, no. This motion is carried. We'll now proceed to the special order of business. Would the clerk please read the resolution?
Senate Concurrent Resolution 202 in Memoriam Mark Hatfield, 1922-2011.
Recognize Senator Betsy Johnson, please.
Mr. President, colleagues, I rise today on this, the 153rd anniversary of Oregon statehood, to pay tribute to an individual who will always be remembered as one of the most influential and respected individuals in the remarkable history of our state. It was 61 years ago last month in the House chamber of this Capitol when then 29-year-old Dean of Men at Willamette University raised his hand and took the oath of office as the newly elected Oregon State Representative. His name, of course, was Mark Odom Hatfield. And from January 1951 through January 1997, he would serve 46 consecutive years in public life, 4 years as a state representative, 2 years as a state senator, 2 years as Secretary of State, 8 years as governor, and 30 years as United States Senator. Throughout his career, he never lost an election, and he never lost the trust of his fellow Oregonians, as he earned a reputation as a public servant of unquestioned intelligence, integrity, and effectiveness. Nobody served Oregon longer than Mark Hatfield, and nobody understood Oregon better. There was not a community in this state he did not visit, or that he did not positively impact. And when he retired from public office in 1997, he did not remain in Washington, D.C., as so many who served there do. Rather, he and his beloved wife, Antoinette, who was always his rock of Gibraltar, returned home to Oregon. He continued his lifelong dedication to making a difference through teaching at a number of universities, through involvement in the Oregon Historical Society, and through service on the OHSU Board of Directors. Many tributes have been paid to Senator Hatfield in the months since his passing, and the resolution that will receive our unanimous support today is a fitting and appropriate addition to those many tributes. But at the end of the day, the most eloquent tributes to the life and career of Mark Hatfield are not those written on paper. Rather, they are the highways, the bridges, the hospitals that were built because of his service on this Senate Appropriations Committee. They are the natural treasures like the Columbia River Gorge that were protected because of his vision. They are the men and women who served as interns and staffers in the senator's office, and those people returned to Oregon to assume leadership positions in their own communities. Like my parents before me, I was privileged to call Mark Hatfield a friend. I will always treasure the conversations we had and the lessons that he taught me. And I conclude my remarks with a story he shared with me about one of his visits with Mother Teresa in Calcutta, India. After spending the day with Mother Teresa as she ministered to the poorest of the poor in the slums of Calcutta, Senator Hatfield asked her how she was able to go to work every day, knowing that for every life she touched, there were literally tens of thousands that were beyond her reach. Mother Teresa responded by saying, "God did not call me to be successful. He called me to be faithful." Mr. President, by any definition, Mark Hatfield lived an incredibly successful life. But far more important to him is the fact that he lived a faithful life. Faithful to his best friend, his wife Antoinette, faithful to his children, faithful to his state and his country, and faithful to his God. May God always bless Mark Hatfield. I urge your unanimous support today.
We're now under discussion. Recognize Senator Rod Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. President. When I was a young man thinking about running for public office, I read Mark Hatfield's book, Between a Rock and a Hard Place, and it resonated with me, and it taught me a lot. Later on, when I was a Metro Councilor, I had the opportunity to lead the three-county delegation back to Washington, D.C. to lobby our folks, our delegation, for money for highways and for light rail. Mark Hatfield always invited us into his office and treated us with the utmost courtesy and listened carefully to what we had to say. I really respect that. Later on, I had another opportunity to get even closer to Mark Hatfield. He was an adjunct professor at George Fox University, and he was teaching classes about Vietnam and other things. And I had an opportunity to be an adjunct professor at George Fox University teaching American history and government. And I went in, and when they hired me, and they said, "Now, would you mind sharing an office
with Mark Hatfield. And I said, oh, no, that would be just fine. But they said, now listen, his name is on the door of that office, and yours isn't. And that's because he's Mark Hatfield, and you're not. I had an opportunity as we shared that office to chat with the good senator many times. He's truly one of my mentors and truly one of my life heroes.
Recognize Senator Jackie Winters, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I think those of us who have known or had some knowledge or interaction with Mark Hatfield take away not only that which is written in the annals and the books, but also some of us have very personal memories of Senator Mark Hatfield. And my first memory of Mark Hatfield was when he was first elected as governor. And in my community of Albina in Portland, Oregon, this Republican governor was remarkable to my community because he and some of his legislative colleagues, he led the discussion, the debate, and the passage of the housing discrimination in our state. And when he was elected governor, I was very confident that he would also be that charge and that lightning rod to eliminate employment discrimination in this state. In 1959, I was employed by the University of Oregon Medical School, and that was my first step to beginning my life of public service, thanks to Governor Hatfield. I had the opportunity following that as the, in 1977, when I was attempting to do some research in trying to identify, for the record, for my father, my great-grandmother's Native American heritage. And knowing that Senator Hatfield was a student, a history student of Herbert Hoover, I called on his office to assist me in this endeavor. And John Oberdorf, who was on his staff at the time, did a lot of research and help in helping me to help my father in order to validate an Indian entitlement that my great-grandmother received in 1912. And I was deeply honored by Senator Hatfield in 1981 when he supported my nomination to serve as the Undersecretary of Department of Education in the Reagan administration. I think all of us, a lot of us in this state of ours, are touched in a lot of ways by the service, the statesmanship, and the caring of a statesman who cared deeply about the citizens of this state. And for me, as a Black Oregonian, I can't tell you how much he touched and what he did my life.
Recognize Senator Frank Morris, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Colleagues, I rise as a recipient, a constituent of Senator Mark Hatfield's help. And I would share with you just briefly the kind of help that he provided. My daughter was working in Guangzhou, China. She met her now husband. They were engaged to be married. They had set the date for their marriage. They allowed a tremendously long time in order for him to achieve his visa to travel to America and be married to my daughter. They would go to the embassy every day waiting to see if the visa had arrived. Day after day after day, I engaged an attorney to help in this process to no avail. And then I called Senator Hatfield and explained to him the situation and asked for his assistance. And on the day before the plane was to depart, my daughter and her fiance once again went to the embassy, and the embassy said, we will grant you your visa. We have been instructed from a very high authority to issue you a visa. And consequently, my daughter and her fiance were able to arrive in America, and we had the wedding as scheduled, and I have been forever blessed by the actions of Senator Mark Hatfield.
Recognize Senator Fred G. Rod, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. I too rise in support of this memorial. And one of the facts that Senator Johnson did not mention about Mark Hatfield when he won the House of Representatives seat was along the way, one of the people that he defeated happened to be my father. History repeats itself. But what was kind of ironic about that is they became very, very good friends. And Mark Hatfield, when he was in the legislature, would come out to Staten, which at that time was about 1,500, sit in my dad owned a grocery store, sit in the butcher shop, and believe it or not, would eat bologna. And talk to the people that were the locals there. So I grew up with people like Mark Hatfield in the store. Now, when my father passed away a few years ago, I had a lot of time to talk to him. It was a long, drawn-out illness. And I asked him, what was one of the best things? Tell me the best things that ever happened to you in life. And he told me the best thing that ever happened to him was the fact that he got beat for the legislature. So take that in mind, folks. I am going the opposite way my dad probably would have planned, but he did very well in business. Mark Hatfield did a wonderful job. My dad was always there for him. And I consider him a very good friend, and I consider him a very good friend of the family, and I hope you support this memorial.
Further remarks by my fellow senators? Senator Jason Atkinson, do you wish to close, please?
As I am asked to close on this memorial today, I will tell you that I feel completely without the authority to do so. My interactions with the senator were of an intern appreciating his love for Abraham Lincoln, seeing him around the state, but I do not feel worthy to finish this debate. So much of what we have said has been said, and all of the people who have chimed in on his passing from around the world and lives that he has touched, people that he has led, and stands that he has taken. It is not lost on me at all that this is a boy from Dallas, Oregon, raised in what now modern day we would say old-fashioned, who was ambitious, who faced tragedy at a young age, who fought for his country, who sought an education, who, as a freshman member of the House of Representatives, led the fight, breaking with his party to end discrimination, which is outside those Senate or the House representative walls that we passed. He had a philosophy of government that if it doesn't work in small town Oregon, it doesn't work anywhere. I have tried to live by that example. He adopted Silverton, Oregon. If it didn't work in Silverton, Oregon, it probably didn't work in Oregon, and later it probably wasn't good enough for all of America. He ended his career on the announcement of his retirement in that same small town. He was a man that we celebrate today not because of any one issue. Think about that. We're not celebrating someone who's a politician. He was supportive of the timber industry, but he also worked to protect Oregon's most special places. He was an evangelical Protestant who got along well with people of other faiths. He was pro-life, but supported contraception. He was pro-life, but he was against the death penalty. He was a dove elected in a time in a Senate full of hawks. He was a man who believed in the principle of institution and of elected public life above short-term political speeches. Took me a little while, as I was in preparation and have been with Senator Johnson for a week, to actually get to that point. You see, as he led and became all of the things that he did in Washington, D.C., there was a time and there was a battle that came up. Many of you recall a balanced budget amendment. And he was very vocal for years and years before that vote ever came up that it didn't need to be in the Constitution, but yet the politics, the institution, if it had political discipline, could balance the budget. He supported having a balanced budget, but he thought that it should come from discipline in the Senate. When the vote actually came up, there was a young upstart politician who went around berating Senator Hatfield and making a name for himself, saying he wasn't conservative enough. He did not sacrifice enough. He was not a team player enough. He should be removed from his chairmanship. He offered to resign to Bob Dole, then the leader of the Senate, and Bob Dole, out of wisdom, said no. Interesting, as in preparation for that, that one senator is now running for President of the United States. A very similar thing happened when, in 1994, and the relationships that he had in the House, one of his colleagues was about to, after, I think, and my good friend Mark Landauer can correct me, I think the House member had been in office for 18 years, working his way up, about to become chairman of the same committee on the House side that Hatfield did, was passed over because that chairman worked too close with the other side. He wasn't partisan enough. And so Hatfield, and one of the greatest stories and the greatest testament of being a gentleman, walked over to the Senate, over to the House, something that senators don't do, as House members today can attest. And he presented that man with a cactus. You have to be a Hatfield staffer to know what the cactus means. He was firm but respectful. He was solid yet kind-hearted. He knew the loneliness of conviction. Preparation for this morning, I went in, even just into my office. I have a particular affection for President Hoover, and Senator Hatfield and I had exchanged letters quite a bit. He sent me a book on Hoover. But as I looked at what America has known that we've lost, Tom Brokaw entered his name and story in a book titled The Greatest Generation. There's another book here called The Lonely Walk. There's a book already referenced called Between a Rock and a Hard Place. There's another book on my desk called Against the Grain, Reflections of a Rebel Republican. We don't celebrate him for issues. We celebrate him for principles. And I think it is a very fitting tribute as we reflect on him is to ask ourselves the hard questions. And the hard questions are, is there anyone serving in public life today who could have a book written about them called The Lonely Walk? Is there anybody serving today that knows the absolute loneliness of conviction? It's not popular today to be bipartisan or for one member of a party to become friends with another member of the party and to go out to lunch with them, to become friends with them, to invest in their families. But yet Senator Hatfield did that. That is our legacy. Of all the things and tributes to him, there's a phrase that I always try to instill in my son that I will reflect on you just by not even being qualified to say such a thing, but I will believe that this is true, that Senator Hatfield was a world-class friend. I want my boy to be a world-class friend to somebody. I want him to know what friendship is, not acquaintance, not support, not verbal, yes, I'll be with you. No, I want to know what friendship means. You can't be as successful as Senator Hatfield is without knowing the bonds of friendship. As we finish today, we know that this is going to pass. We know that his legacy is surrounded in these staffers up here. And I see some up here. I see one right here. They all knew something. Books have been written about a man, not because he was a dove among hawks, not because he balanced conservation, not because of his life stance, not even because of his Christianity. There's a deeper thing here that is really the legacy of Mark Hatfield. And that is, in public service, are we brave enough, like Hatfield was, to stand on principle? Are we convicted enough to stand on principle? Do we know why we do this job? Senator Hatfield was asked, was pressured, and oftentimes wondered in some of these books if he should walk away from public service, that America wasn't ready for a guy like him. But he didn't walk away. He kept going. We have to ask ourselves as Oregonians, do we still have that belief? Do we still want public servants of principle? Do we still want people that go against the grain, that walk a lonely walk, that can be between a rock and a hard place? Will we celebrate that? As I urge all of us to support, as I'm sure all of you will, SCR 202, I only have one question, which is a haunting question to me, which is a haunting question that passes all party lines, which is a haunting question that passes not only the House and the Senate and all the candidates are running for office and all the people are involved. There's only one question of the legacy that we have in this resolution. Would Oregon recognize a Mark Hatfield today?
The question now arises upon the third reading and the final passage of SCR 202. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will answer aye as the names are called, and those opposed, no. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Atkinson?
Yes.
Bates?
Yes.
Beyer?
Aye.
Boquist?
Aye.
Burdick?
Aye.
Devlin?
Aye.
Dingfelder?
Aye.
Edwards?
Aye.
Perioli?
Aye.
Perioli? George?
Aye.
Gerard?
Aye.
Haas?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Cruz? Monis Anderson, Monroe, Morse, Nelson, Olson, Prezansky, Rosenbaum, Shields, Starr, Steiner Hayward, Telfer, Thompson, Berger, Whitsitt, Winters, President Courtney.
Yes.
30 aye votes.
SCR 2, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. The Oregon State Senate on this day, Oregon's 53rd birthday, has just paid its highest tribute to Mark Odom Hatfield. Again, to the family and friends that are here, it is an honor and privilege to have you here. We hope that in some small way, this recognition of this extraordinary human being, not only as a person, but to this great state and her people, is going to be recorded in your hearts. You know how profoundly proud we are of Mark Odom Hatfield and how we've attempted through this resolution to set in history for all time the recognition of all that he has done for all of us, all those that have come before, and all that will come in the future. Thank you. We will now move on to other issues. Recognize Senator Dianne Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that consideration of Senate Bill 1580 be taken from its place on today's third reading calendar and be made a special order of business immediately.
Senator Dianne Rosenbaum has moved that the consideration of SB 1580 be taken from its place on today's third reading calendar and be made a special order of business immediately. To your motion.
Thank you, Mr. President. Colleagues, this is an extremely important bill, and by taking this action, it will allow us to take it up immediately, and I recommend that we do so.
Is there discussion? If there's no further discussion, Senator Rosenbaum, do you wish to close?
No, thank you.
The question is on taking SB 1580 from today's third reading calendar and making it a special order of business immediately. Those in favor will answer aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, no. This motion has carried. We will now recognize Senator Farioli.
Mr. President, are we properly under the order of propositions and motions?
Not quite.
Thank you, Mr. President.
I didn't know whether you were continuing to object to the previous motion.
No.
We will now proceed to the special order of business. Let me just say, we all know that the issue about to come before us has had a very difficult journey. It is a contentious issue, and it will be presented and discussed and debated at times, I'm sure, in a very vigorous way. All I ask is that in doing so, that we do so in a way that shows respect for each other, regardless of where we stand on this issue or how we would vote and will vote on this issue, so that when we complete our work, whatever may happen on this issue, that we have brought respect to each other, to the state Senate, and to the people of Oregon. And I thank you for letting me make that statement, my fellow senators. Would the clerk please read the bill?
Senate Bill 1580, relating to health care delivery and declaring an emergency.
I will now recognize Senator Bates. I believe that is the procedure, correct, Secretary of Senate? Right. And then I recognize you, Senator Farioli, at that time. Thank you. Go ahead, Senator Bates.
And colleagues, we spend twice as much money per person in the United States than any other industrialized country in the world, and we have some of the worst outcomes. Our health care system is literally awash in dollars, and yet we rate, at best, 40th in the world as far as health care outcomes. 80% of the healthcare dollars are spent by 20% of the population. Many of these people have illnesses that simply strike out of the blue, such as leukemia or a terrible accident. But many, and probably the majority, suffer from chronic illnesses such as diabetes or congestive heart failure, which are compounded by mental illness and or drug and alcohol addictions, which prevent the treatment of their physical illnesses. These people chronically cycle between doctor's offices, hospitals, and treatment centers, producing massive medical costs. Colleagues, I see these people in my practice every single day. They go to the emergency room at 3 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday night, confused with their schizophrenia or under the influence of drugs. They're released from there 3 or 4 days later after being hospitalized of tens of thousands of dollars a day. They come out, they hit the street, they don't get back to their primary care physician, they don't get to their treatment centers, and a week or two or three later, they're back in the hospital, being recycled through, rehospitalized, running up huge health care dollars. That is the key to what's wrong with our health care system. We don't integrate with each other, and we don't work together to give these people the wraparound services they need. They are trapped in an expensive and siloed system that produces health care costs that are not sustainable for Medicaid and Medicare, and through cost shifts that are not sustainable for commercial insurance companies and the private businesses those insurance companies serve. Other states have tried to deal with these issues. They have disenrolled people from Medicaid, they've tried to cut benefits, they've tried to cut payment to providers. These measures have all failed and have ultimately ended up producing more cost shift. Here in Oregon, over the last 10 years, we have had some success and bending the cost curve through the use of managed care organizations. It is estimated that over the last 10 years, these organizations have saved the state nearly $10 billion in health care costs. However, further savings have not been made possible due to the isolation of mental health and drug and alcohol treatment from physical health. I would point out again that the health care organizations we have in these states, or this state, are unique. I know of no other state that has the kind of managed care we have for Medicaid patients. House Bill 3650 promised to build these successes and promised to open the door to a new integrated system by forming community-driven coordinated care organizations. Since the passage of House Bill 3650, our local communities have already started moving forward on CCOs. Right here in Marion County, over 400 physicians are working with county government, mental health, community, and behavioral health leaders in conjunction with hospitals in the surrounding areas. In Douglas County, the first steps to forming a CCO have already occurred with the community coming together on its own. In Josephine and Jackson counties, the local NCO has helped draw all the interested parties together to forge relations critical to the creation of a CCO. In Coos Bay, physicians, hospital administrators, local community leaders, and health leaders have been meeting and are moving forward. The Good Samaritan system has been reaching out to its community discussing CCOs. In the Portland area, the Tri-County Collaborative is working hard on integration of forum CCOs. With the passage of Senate Bill 1580, all these efforts can become a reality. I did not think I would ever see a day when in the Tri-County area, those major healthcare systems would sit down and have open conversations with one another about how they could produce the best health in the people they serve. House Bill 3650 cannot be implemented without legislative release given by Senate Bill 1580. However, Senate Bill 1580 does more than simply allow House Bill 3650 to go forward. It places necessary sideboards on the Oregon Health Authority and clarifies legislative intent. The sideboards are as follows. Greater transparency in reporting as requested by Senator Morris. Currently, our MCOs file reports and are audited regularly. These requirements will be carried forward to all whom participate. We are especially thankful to Senator Morris for bringing his business expertise to this discussion. It protects those forming a CCO to meet and discuss the process without violating antitrust laws. It creates an arbitration process to address problem areas and maintains the current reimbursement structure, such as the non-participation rule. In other words, if entities cannot come to an agreement on issues concerning finances, the present non-participation statute will be used. I want that point made very clear here today. The bill clearly spells out that in any given community, especially a community that is large in size, more than one CCO should be considered, especially if significant entities are excluded from the governance process. And quite frankly, colleagues, as Senator Shields has pointed out, initially in the Tri-County area, there were significant concerns about public and provider participation at the executive level. Through the good senator's work, that concern has been partially addressed. Thank you, Senator Shields. Senate Bill 1580 also outlines the requirements to manage risk and reserves within a CCO by maintaining the current process, which has worked well in our present managed care contracting system. It further creates a process where metrics for evaluation will be developed. It addresses the global budget discussion as required by House Bill 3650. It outlines the makeup and role of the Community Advisory Council. It provides structure of the governance requirement, ensures participation of all major providers, including dental MCOs, within the governance structure. It identifies innovator agents, which can be put in place only at the request of the CCO, not OHA, but the request of the CCO, in order to streamline communication between the state and the CCO. These are not new positions. They will be filled by the current OHA staff. It establishes the need for experience in CCOs of those who have successfully served Oregonians within the current system can, if they so desire, become a CCO as long as they meet the other requirements under the law. It establishes a clear method to examine the cost of defensive medicine and brings recommended legislation back to the next regular legislative session. Let me repeat that, colleagues. We're talking about legislation here, not kicking the can further down the road. And finally, for OHSU, adds language specific for potential funding streams, which may enhance the process. So what happens if this bill does not pass? We will remain a dysfunctional system that ultimately cannot be borne financially by our state or our business community. We will have an immediate $600 to $700 million total funds hole in our state budget, which will have to be addressed through cuts to physicians, hospitals, and others. Cuts of up to 30%. Up to 30%. This would destroy the Oregon Health Plan. These kinds of cuts will force physicians to leave the plan, would also jeopardize the financial viability of many of our hospitals. The savings brought by Senate Bill 1580 are not just savings for Oregon. For every dollar we save, the federal government actually saves a dollar and a half. We call this shared savings. This is the real reason the federal government has expressed a willingness to share up to $500 million a year for the next 5 years. Colleagues, we cannot afford to turn our back on these shared savings or a new system which will help reduce health care costs, produce better outcomes, and help the neediest Oregonians. I realize many of you are unhappy that MedMail isn't prominent in this legislation. However, I doubt any of you have possibly paid as much in real dollars and seen the personal pain of colleagues being sued in our present tort system as Senator Steiner Hayward and I have. Every day when I see a patient, I am concerned, as many of my colleagues are, that this patient could sue me for something I'm going to do or not do. There's nothing more important to us than getting this tort reform done, but now is not the time or the place. We need a well-thought-out process for doing it and good legislation. Senator Hayward and I are dedicated to bring a bill to the floor for an up or down vote on MedMail reform in the next session. I will take whatever steps are necessary to make that happen. The governor who previously brought us MedMail reform to the state is as committed as we are. In closing, colleagues, Oregon has a history of original and nation-leading public policy changes that make a real and positive difference in people's lives. This bill continues that legacy by initiating the first statewide, locally controlled, fully integrated healthcare system in the United States. We need to show the courage to let go of the old system, no matter how comfortable we are with it and how dysfunctional it is, and move to a new system which promises lower cost and better health for our citizens. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll now recognize Senator Ted Farioli, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move that the rules be suspended for the purpose of amending Senate Bill 1580 with the -7 amendments, which will put all physicians in a community care organization under the Oregon Tort Claims Act. Mr. President, the amendment has been distributed to the members' desks.
Senator Farioli has moved that the rules be suspended for purpose of amending SB 1580 with the -7 amendments, which will put all physicians in a CCO under the Oregon Tort Claims Act. The amendment has been distributed to the members' desk. This motion is properly before the Senate. It is not debatable. The maker of the motion is entitled to a brief description of the motion. Senator Telfer, for what purpose is your light on, please?
Oh, Mr. President, I just need to declare a potential conflict of all this discussion that's about to transpire.
Could you hold it? State and declare your potential conflict of interest.
I have a daughter that works for St. Charles Medical Center and may be affected by the outcome of this legislation.
Thank you. Your potential conflict of interest has now been officially placed in the record. Senator Chip Shields, for what purpose do you rise?
A potential conflict as well, Mr. President.
Then please place that potential conflict of interest on the record.
My spouse is a primary care provider that may be affected by this legislation.
Your potential conflict of interest has now been placed officially on the record. Senator Fred Girod.
Thank you, Mr. President. I need to declare a potential conflict.
Please place your potential conflict on the record.
I'm a licensed dentist in the state of Oregon.
Again, you're just a little clear because I was talking.
I'm a licensed dentist in the state of Oregon, and I could benefit from this amendment.
Thank you. Your potential conflict of interest has now been placed on the record. Are there other members of the Senate that may or may not, well, I was going to say may not, that doesn't work, may have a potential conflict of interest? Senator Chuck Thompson, for what purpose do you rise?
I have the same conflict of interest possibly as Senator Telfer. My daughter works for the Providence Medical Hospital and system in Hood River.
Thank you. Your potential conflict of interest has now been placed on the record. Are there any others? Senator Bates, do you wish to get up and say you didn't? Senator Bates?
Following the lead of the good Senator Johnson, in abundance of caution, I have two daughters, a wife, and myself who work in the healthcare system, and a great dog, but I don't think
That dog's infected right now.
Your potential conflict of interest has now been placed on the record. Are there any other potential conflict of interest, real or perceived, that individuals would like to put on the record? Seeing none, Senator Farioli, your description of your motion, please.
Yes, Mr. President. We honored Mark Capdeal today as a man who put principle above party politics. I'm asking in this motion with the amendment to allow protection for doctors who accept Medicare Medicaid patients in the community care organizations to protect them from tortuous liability. Mr. President, I am asking all of our members to put principle above party politics and allow consideration of the Dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 1580. Thank you, Mr. President.
The question is on the suspension of the rules for the purpose of amending Senate Bill 1580 with the Dash 7 amendments. Those in favor will answer aye as their names are called. Those opposed, no. Would the clerk now please read the roll call, please.
Make
the roll call.
Beyer. Boquist. Burdick. Devlin. Dingfelder. Edwards. Farioli. George. Gerard. Haas. Johnson. Cruz. Montes Anderson. Monroe. Morse. Nelson. Olson, Prezansky, Rosenbaum, Shields, Starr, Steiner-Hayward, Telfer, Thompson, Verger, Whitsitt, Winters, President Courtney,
no,
Atkinson, voting no, Bates, Beyer, Burdick, Devlin, Dingfelder, Edwards, Haas, Johnson, Montes Anderson, Monroe, Prezansky, Rosenbaum, Shields, Steiner-Hayward, Berger, President Courtney.
The motion has failed. Senator Nelson, for what purpose do you rise?
Thank you, Mr. President.
For the record, the bill is now, just 1 second.
Propositions.
The bill is now before us. I recognize Senator Dave Nelson.
Are we still in the propositions?
Yes, we are. I had to state the bill is now before us. We're now under proposition motion. Continue to make. We're under debate, but proposition motion. Please proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. President. I move that Senate Bill 1580 be re-referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Dave Nelson has moved that Senate Bill 1580 be re-referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This motion requires a majority present to carry. The motion is debatable. I now recognize Senator Nelson to explain your motion, please. The motion to re-refer, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. President. I sit on Ways and Means, and on last Friday, the Dash 9 amendments were brought to the bill. We had very little time to process those amendments. There was Dash 7's admitted also, that was the tort reform. It was one of those situations where, for the benefit of, I think, the body, the perception that we have out here, if we're actually doing our job, we need more time to look at this. I mean, we're looking at a situation where on the tort reform, there's a potentially $20 million savings. I don't know whether that's true or not. We didn't have any testimony. We had nothing that came before us as a legislative body to make a decision upon the merits of the amendments. Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you.
Recognize Senator Jeff Cruz, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Colleagues, I think it's appropriate. I would also point out the fact that when the Dash 7 amendments came up in full Ways and Means last Friday, the majority of the Senate senators on that committee supported the inclusion of the Dash 7s. Mr. President, I have heard from countless physicians who have told me that if we're making this dramatic change in the healthcare system without tort reform, they're uncomfortable. And quite honestly, Mr. President, some might choose not to participate in this new structure. I would say, Mr. President, that all the promises of what we could do in 13, in my mind, ring hollow without a forcing function, and this would, the sevens would do that. Let's give healthcare practitioners some level of certainty that we are indeed serious about tort reform, and without the dash sevens in the bill, we can't give them that certainty. At this point, Mr. President, the only way to put that in is to send this back to committee and have that amendment put in the bill. So I urge, I vote on the re-referral.
Recognize Senator Bustar, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Colleagues, I stand in support of the motion. Actually, I would prefer that the bill be referred back to a policy committee where the policy that's incorporated in this particular piece of legislation could be worked out, as opposed to the budget committee. But in light of the fact that we have the motion to refer to Ways and Means, I will support that motion, though I question whether or not we should be doing policy work in the budget committee, the Ways and Means Committee, Mr. President.
Okay. Recognize Senator Chuck Thompson, please.
Mr. President, I spoke to a doctor just this morning from my district over in the Sandy area, Dr. Matthew Saw, and he explained to me that doctors practice defensive medicine to prevent frivolous malpractice claims. The two issues are connected. Malpractice reform is a step towards transforming Oregon's healthcare from defensive to preventative, and you can't have one without the other. And I think this is a great chance. This body's gotten along great. My first session, we did some great things, and I think this is a real chance for us to, if we accept this dash seven motion, to work this in a nonpartisan manner. And I believe we could come out with a 30-0 vote and show great support for this bill. Thank you.
Senator Bates, do you wish to comment?
Thank you, Mr. President. Just a quick comment so we get on the record some things that I think need to be said here. One, this bill is about the budget. We have a $700 million hole in that budget, and we have to close that hole one way or another. If we don't pass this bill, we don't close that hole. We do it by cuts. So this is about money. Is about ways and means. It also is about policy, because policy and ways and means can rarely ever be separated. Number two, we can't bind the next legislative session no matter what we do here today. Dash sevens try to do that, but you can't. Number three, if we were to pass the dash sevens, it would open up some questions that we've had asked by the DOJ about what this really means as far as what this dash seven would do. And there are some ramifications which none of us really know the answer to. This is premature and inappropriate trying to pass this at this time. We need to move this forward. We've got about 2 weeks left, 2.5 weeks left this session. We have to leave at that point. We have to rebalance our budgets. We have to do what we can to safeguard Oregonians. We do not have time to send this back to committee, work on it, and bring it back in any form that it's not in right now. It is in good shape at this point. It does what it needs to do. It does what 3650 told us we wanted to do. The dash nines, to be clear, took one sentence out, essentially took one sentence out of the original bill, clarifying the non-participation language. That's what we did, because that one sentence was confusing to people and difficult to interpret. I would again say that we should not send it back to committee, and I would ask for a no vote.
Recognize Senator Fred Girod, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. I sit on Ways and Means, and I would just like to say that the hole that we have is supposedly a $239 million hole that was put there with the assumption that there was going to be $239 million worth of savings by doing this. Now, it's also come to light that there's going to be a $500 million, or roughly $500 million, bailout from President Obama, and that will occur just right before the elections. So that offers a $64,000 question. If there truly is a $239 million savings in this, why do we need a $500 million bailout from the federal government, which will roll up every biennium? It's going to be more and more.
This is a failed system. It will not work. The numbers don't jive. It was sold to us as this big cost savings, but if we need the $500 million to make the balanced budget, then it makes absolutely no sense, and there actually is a $261 million deficit. There is no $700 million shortfall. Right now it's $239, and that was put there by the governor.
Senator Nelson, do you wish to close on your motion?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. President. I mean, this is about money. We have the potential of $20 million sitting on the table. How many times have I been in this body where we passed a bill and said, well, this isn't a perfect bill. If it's not quite perfect, we'll fix it in the next go-around. But we have $20 million that was brought forth, as I understand, and I don't know if this is true or not, by the Oregon Health Authority with their own study, at least $20 million of savings. That money could get back to our patients. I mean, from my viewpoint, we are not doing our job here. Thank you, Mr. President.
The motion before us is to re-refer Senate Bill 1580 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Those in favor will answer aye as their names are called, and those opposed, no. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Beyer? Boquist?
Aye.
Burdick?
No.
Devlin?
No.
Dingfelder? Edwards?
No.
Ferrioli?
Aye.
George?
Aye.
Gerard?
Aye.
Haas? Johnson? Cruz?
Aye.
Montes Anderson?
Aye.
Monroe?
No.
Morse?
Aye.
Nelson?
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Przanski?
No.
Rosenbaum?
No.
Shields?
No.
Starr?
Steiner
Hayward?
No.
Telfer?
Aye.
Thompson?
Aye.
Berger?
No.
Whitsitt?
Aye.
Winters?
Aye.
Atkinson?
Yes.
Bates?
No.
President Courtney?
No.
Voting no, Bates, Beyer, Burdick, Devlin, Dingfelder, Edwards, Haas, Johnson, Montes Anderson, Monroe, Przanski, Rosenbaum, Shields, Steiner Hayward, Berger, President Courtney, 14 aye votes.
The motion has failed. The Senate Bill 1580 is now before the Senate under discussion. Recognize Senator Frank Morris, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Colleagues, I find myself in an unfortunate situation today, rising in opposition to this bill. When you appointed, Mr. President, the Commission on Healthcare Access and Affordability, and I believe it was after the 05 session. I participated in that. I participated in all of the policy formations leading to what we now have in Senate Bill 1580. And I have been a strong advocate of healthcare transformation. There's much that we don't know about how this will work out, but we have to give it a shot. But the component that's missing is the component that I would like to speak to today. I would ask you, colleagues, when in the history of the Oregon legislature has there been an honest effort to make comprehensive changes to our medical liability laws? When? When? Does anyone here remember when? Bills are routinely introduced each session and just as routinely dismissed, session after session after session after session. I recall personally trying to bring physicians and trial attorneys together to find common ground for medical liability reform. The effort was fruitless and, quite frankly, a waste of time. I do recall the legislative response in 2009 to the OHSU crisis brought about by the Oregon Supreme Court Clark versus OHSU decision. The Oregon Tort Claims Act was amended for the benefit of OHSU to the tune of about $31 million a year in savings for that great institution. But I also recall the response by our good Senator Prozanski. When asked on this Senate floor why broader tort reform was not also considered, the date was on February 23, 2009, when he responded, and I quote, "I am willing to reopen that door for a discussion, but not during this session because we don't have time," end quote. Remember, nearly 4 months remained in that session. Of course, we had the 2011 session to deal with the matter. And what happened in the 2011 session? I recall that the Oregon Health Policy Board was charged to analyze and recommend medical liability reforms for legislative consideration. And what was the result of that effort? Now, for those of you that participated and watched the 2011 Healthcare Transformation Work Group, you know the answer to that question. And during the opening and the continuing dialogue in that transformation effort, when the governor and the health authority laid out the charge to the work group, was there a challenge to reform the medical malpractice laws to address the high cost of defensive medicine? Well, colleagues, if there was, it certainly escaped me. But what I do recall was that the legislative members on that work group had to request a report from the work of the Health Fund Board regarding medical liability reforms. We had to ask for it, even though it was a charge. When the brief report was given, it became very clear why medical malpractice reform was not included in the Oregon Health Authority's list of challenges and opportunities given to the work group. The report, in my judgment, was an embarrassment, colleagues, and those of us that witnessed it on that night when it was delivered, I think, shared that same feeling, and a clear indication that tort reform would not be a part of healthcare transformation. We had had time after time after time, and the issue had been ignored. The history is so perfectly clear in this body. There never has been, there certainly is not today, and anyone with an informed judgment of past history would never believe there will be in the future comprehensive medical liability reforms. Senate Bill 1580 calls for a governor-led work group to make recommendations by October 1, 2012. Colleagues, without what I would call a backstop to keep the ball in play, why would anyone today trust that reforms will actually occur? What is different today than it was yesterday, last month, last year, or 20 years for that matter? The work group is a hope and a promise without any forcing function to change. Friends, if we truly want healthcare transformation to succeed, and all of us do, that is a passion that we have. We want it to succeed. But we have a very real responsibility to provide those medical providers who will be in the firing line, of unlimited tort liability. We need to give those people an assurance that medical liability reform will be a part and parcel to the transformation effort. Colleagues, this bill today provides no assurance other than a work group. And we've been down that road before. Friends, I would refer to you, amongst all of the papers on your desk today, that you read letters from physicians in my district. Please read them. And you will see in those letters the response of providers in an unlimited medical liability environment. You will see the way medicine is practiced. Please read those letters. We do have the opportunity today to assure our medical providers who will be asked to serve more patients at less cost an assurance that when they practice at the top of their medical licenses, and colleagues, this is something from day one, the commission that you charged, Mr. President, the Healthcare Access and Affordability Commission, One of the charges was, how do we get physicians to operate at the top of their license? These people have a reasonable expectation that their increased risks will in fact be mitigated. Colleagues, this picture became perfectly clear to me in a recent Samaritan Health System board meeting to discuss transformation. Now, I went to that board meeting expecting to discuss the particulars of the overarching transformation effort that this bill represents. But what we discussed was the transformation this bill will drive within physician and hospital practices. Colleagues, there will be profound changes in how physicians practice medicine. Budget restraints will force physicians to truly operate at the top of their licenses because there will be not enough money, quite frankly, to pay for the abundance of caution so common to imaging, lab tests, specialist referrals, and hospital admissions. As a matter of public policy, we want medical decisions to be clinically based. It makes sense. Dollars are too precious to apply to defensive medicine, but adoption of this bill today, unamended, to include a forcing function to give an absolute assurance, colleagues, that medical liability reforms will be implemented are unrealistic at best and unethical at the worst because of what we're doing to the provider community, asking them to assume greater risk in an environment that has literally unlimited access to liability for these providers. We all want healthcare transformation to succeed. We're not obstructionists today in this debate, but the bill before us today allows the foundation for failure, absent a mechanism to assure an honest and thoughtful effort to bring our laws into line with our expectations from our health provider community. I would close with this comment, colleagues. Bill Ayer, he's the CEO of Alaska Airlines, was recently quoted in a Wall Street Journal article when asked about running his business. He said, "Hope is not a strategy. We don't spend a lot of time counting on things we can't control." End quote. Colleagues, Senate Bill 1580 is hope without a strategy. Amending this bill to include the Oregon tort claims coverage for coordinated care organizations would have given hope for a strategy for success. I urge you to thoughtfully consider your vote today. Do you wish to count on things you can't control? Then vote yes. If you wish to count on truly comprehensive medical malpractice reform, something you can control, vote no. Colleagues, this bill is not ready for adoption. It is not ready for adoption. We have left out one of the most important components of healthcare transformation, and it is not the organization of CCOs. It's the transformation that occurs within the provider community and the intending increased risk at operating at the top of their licenses. And it's just not fair. I would like to compliment the governor in leading this work group effort, but I have to stand in face of the history, the legislative history in this body, that has failed time after time after time to address comprehensive medical malpractice reform. Thank you, colleagues, for the indulgence for my time today, and thank you, Mr. President.
Senator Chuck Thompson and Senator Alan Olson have both yielded their times. Recognize Senator Jeff Cruz, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Colleagues, I agree with everything my good colleague just stated, it's an absolute fact that this bill is not ready. I want to go back just a little bit in history, not too long ago, 2011. We passed a bill, House Bill 3650. What that bill did was set out a whole bunch of tasks that the Oregon Health Authority was supposed to perform and report back to us. And I'm saying this from the perspective of the fact that when it comes to tort reform, we don't have time, okay? Over the interim between sessions, we, during legislative days, traditionally we would spend an hour of our committee time dealing with transformation. And basically we were looking at things from a 30,000 foot view, never any specificity in what we were talking about. There was a request made of leadership to allow the committee more meetings. That did not happen. What we had in lieu of that was conference calls. Now, keeping in mind that because we had to deal with quorum issues, there could only be two senators on any one conference call, and I would suggest conference calls are a really poor way to do business anyway. So that really didn't bear any fruit either. And then I think it was about, because we kept wondering what the governor's bill is going to look like. And I think it was about a week before the session actually started, we saw the bill. Okay. Keep in mind, we're saying on this tort reform, which was a proposal that has been on the table for a couple months, we don't have time. But 1 week before the session, we get the language in the governor's bill. It was assigned to our policy committee. And on the second day the committee was meeting, after some public comment period, we sent the bill unamended to Ways and Means. Senate Bill 1580 originally was a six-page bill. In Ways and Means, which is not supposed to do policy, it's supposed to do budget, in Ways and Means, they amended the bill, and we ended up with a dash 9 amendment, which is 17 pages long. Keep in mind, we don't have time, okay? We don't have time. Let me say one thing about time, for starters. In my opinion, you always have time to do things the right way. And the compression of time is no excuse for doing policy in an inappropriate manner. And in my mind, that is exactly what we've done. This is being driven by budget concerns. Okay, we have to have the $500 million. Okay? So we've asked about the $500 million, and we have been given rough general ideas that how the money is going to arrive. What we have heard from the governor's office and the health authority is that they have been in pretty much daily conversations with CMS about this. And yet we can get no specifics about the money. Dr. Goldberg did say in committee when he was asked if there were strings attached to the money, he said, no, there are ropes attached to the money. That should be of some concern to us. What are going to be the requirements from the federal government for us to receive this money? And how is it going to be distributed? You know, what sort of forcing function is the health authority going to do on these local community organizations that are on the front end of being created to allow them to receive the dollars? Colleagues, we have a history in this state, and especially in the Legislative Assembly, of blindly chasing after federal dollars. Blindly chasing after federal dollars. No Child Left Behind is a perfect example of something that has been an absolute failure, and we blindly chased after those dollars. We need to keep in mind what the objective of the current administration is in healthcare. We set out on this pathway last year to say we are going to do something Oregon-specific in the way we redesign our healthcare system. I would suggest, colleagues, that the ropes attached to this money may move us in a direction we don't want to go, but we may be forced to go there. The federal requirements are incredibly important in this, and yet we know nothing about them, and we are going to pass this bill without any idea of what the feds are going to require from us. That's irresponsible. You know, the communities are moving forward at this point in time, and I applaud them for what they're doing, but one of the things they are chasing is the dollars, because they know what would happen without this infusion of cash. To say that we have a commitment of $500 million every year for the next 5 years, I don't know how anybody can actually make that claim. One would assume at some point in time Congress will actually pass a budget, although they've been over 1,000 days on continuing resolutions, and at that point in time, we don't know how the structure of entitlement programs would be. But I would also suggest on the trajectory we're on now, if this $500 million this year just fills the hole, and next year we're required to double our Medicaid population, how are we going to pay for that? You know, this doesn't pencil out. I would suggest, colleagues, that to do such a monumental and significant change in our system with so much of what's being done behind closed doors. Keep in mind, the Ways and Means Subcommittee did have hearings on the bill when they came out with the Dash 5 amendments, which were about 16, 17 pages long. The advocates were given 2 hours to look at the amendment before they commented on it. The comment period happened. Folks went back in and reconfigured things and came out with the Dash 8 amendments, which turned into the and basically there was no ability for anybody to comment on the Dash 8s. The subcommittee passed it the full, the Dash 9s were adopted a full. Where is the full vetting of these issues? It has not happened. Colleagues, we need to be very careful. And as Senator Moore said, I'm supportive of transforming our healthcare system. I absolutely am. But I'm supportive of transforming it when we have all the pieces on the table and without the forcing function my good friend from Albany talked about. Tort reform is not going to happen. I don't believe a promise because it's been promised and promised and promised. But what is more concerned to me is what strings the feds are going to put on that money and how that drives the formation of whatever we're creating. There's a whole lot of other issues that need to be addressed that I don't think we've appropriately vetted, and that is what the governance structure is going to look like of these organizations. And as MCOs move into CCOs, what happens to their reserves, how they fit into this. And by the way, the MCOs in the state of Oregon combined have reserves of $250 million. There has been no discussion of that. Where does that money go? How does that money fit in? Colleagues, there are some major, major questions that need to be answered before this is passed. And to say we are doing this strictly for the money is irresponsible at best. Keep in mind that we passed the last bill, last session, 3650, because we're going to save nearly a quarter of $1 billion. The savings have not materialized and never were intended to. So we have been driven to a point of trying to get additional federal dollars with ropes attached, not strings, ropes attached, and yet we have no idea what those ropes are. I urge a no vote on this bill. Let's get it right.
Senator Bruce Starr and Senator Jason Atkinson have yielded their time. Yeah, I think that's right. Recognize Senator Lori Moniz Anderson, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Colleagues, nursing has been my professional passion. And yes, that passion has actually continued in this legislature and serving as chair of the Health Policy Committee. And as a nurse, I have spent my entire career caring for the health of others and for Oregonians. And I am tremendously proud and very honored to rise in support of Senate Bill 1580. This legislation transforms for the better the way our state delivers care to Oregonians in need. Today's vote is a very important step toward making quality health care truly accessible to all Oregonians. This bill will cut waste in the system in order to prioritize and protect critical services to the most vulnerable Oregonians and to the middle class. By spending our healthcare dollars more efficiently and by focusing on health outcomes, we can also protect important state services like public safety, education, and senior care from healthcare costs that would otherwise take up a larger share of the budget. Under the health-focused system outlined in Senate Bill 1580, Oregon's vulnerable populations, seniors, poor, and middle-class families will have increased access to physicians, nurses, and specialized healthcare practitioners working together to better serve patients. In these tough economic times, it can be difficult for the everyday Oregonian to find someone who's looking out for them. And this proposal puts the patient first and will create a system of professionals that look out for the health of individual Oregonians instead of an economic bottom line. Hundreds upon hundreds of hours of work by citizens, experts, and members of the Oregon Health Authority work groups, as well as the Health Authority Board, have moved this healthcare conversation along so that we are at the point today where we have the opportunity to vote for better health care at a lower cost. This transformation bill will carry on the historic and significant legislation from 2011. It will allow the Oregon Health Authority to implement coordinated care organizations, and the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Consumer and Business Services will share information about financial reporting of the community care organizations, streamlining for efficiency and better delivery. Each coordinated care organization will have a corresponding advisory council, giving a voice and formal recognition to the community needs and consumer representatives. Providers are protected from discrimination, and a review and appeal system will be established through the Oregon Health Authority. These are significant changes in how we provide care, and Oregon's families and small businesses stand to benefit from them. With these changes in place, Oregon will continue to be a national model in serving its citizens with a health care system that is efficient and prioritizes the ongoing health of the individual. Caring, I love that word. Caring for our fellow Oregonians means putting in place a system that looks after their needs first. Caring means prioritizing the most critical services that Oregonians depend on and making them as efficient as possible. For me, colleagues, caring means voting yes on Senate Bill 1580. Thank you, Mr. President.
I'll now recognize Senator Chris Telfer, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Colleagues, for years now, I have worked with and in my community
to find ways to make our communities, as well as the people living in those communities, healthier. And if 1580 passes, I want to assure, and I want to be on the record, that the fact that I will fight to maintain the regional control over CCOs, as well as the flexibility. I do not want to see a one-size-fits-all superimposed on this eventually down the year. I will continue to fight for the regionalization and the flexibility of CCO. The other thing is this bill perfect? Oh, far from it. This bill is far from being perfect. And so the other thing that I will pledge to you that I will fight for if this bill passes is constant legislative oversight into things that happen so that we can fix things, correct things, make them work, because this bill, as it is written right now, is far, far, far from perfect. So I just want to be on the record of fighting for regionalization and flexibility of CCOs and the fact that the legislature has to keep coming back and tweaking this and improving it. Thank you.
Recognize Senator Doug Whitsitt, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. The senator from Ashland is correct in stating that the current healthcare delivery system in Oregon is not sustainable. But that's really not the question. The question before us today is whether Senate Bill 1580A is the correct way to fix the problem. Mr. President, I'm sometimes faulted for overthinking the issues and maybe being too detail-oriented. I may be guilty as charged. But having said that, I've expended considerable effort comparing the provisions of the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act with the provisions of House Bill 3650 from the 2011 and Senate Bill 1580A before us today that implements that 2011 Act. The federal and state acts are very similar in many ways. Both are essentially government-sponsored single-payer plans that aim to provide universal access to health care. Both acts promise to reduce the cost of health care delivery. The federal act will result in health care rationing, certainly, as well as creating billions of dollars in new and increased taxes to pay for those savings. Senate Bill 1580A also will result in health care rationing, Mr. President, and depends on $2.5 billion in federal funding over the next 5 years to pay for those savings. Both acts fail to address the primary health care delivery cost drivers. Neither act addresses the cost of medical liability insurance or the billions of dollars in defensive medicine costs driven by the failure to address tort reform. Neither act provides for any form of price negotiation at the point of health care delivery between the patient and his provider. Neither the physician nor the patient knows or really cares what it costs because it's not relevant to them because a third party will pay the bill. Neither act provides for meaningful financial participation by the patient. There is no restraint because there is no cost to the patient. Mr. President, MIT economist Jonathan Gruber, who is one of the chief architects and one of the most vocal supporters of the Patient Protection and Affordability Care Act, he recently reversed his opinion. He reversed his position last week, as a matter of fact. He rebutted not only the president's contentions, but his own contentions made in 2009. He recently told Wisconsin officials that implementation of the federal act would result in a 31% increase in premiums for 59% of the individual market. I want to repeat that, Mr. President. The president's chief economist, his chief advisor, stated that the act would increase premiums 31% for 59% of the individual market. He has calculated that dramatic cost increase would also occur in other states, including Minnesota and Colorado. Colleagues, we appear to be in the process of adopting a Patient Protection and Affordability Care Act West. In my opinion, we are offering up Oregon as a grand West Coast test ground, a grand experiment to see if the Affordable Care Act will actually work. Mr. President, I'm not willing to do that.
Recognize Senator Betsy Johnson, please.
To the bill. Colleagues, I have been a strong advocate for healthcare transformation in Oregon and believe that we have a unique opportunity to both improve health outcomes for Oregonians and realize significant savings for taxpayers. Implementing coordinated care organizations this session is critical to moving forward. I am equally committed to meaningful medical liability reform and am convinced that we will not succeed at creating an effective system, attracting and retaining doctors, and reducing healthcare costs if we ignore this issue. I have been adamant on this point since the inception of the debate in this body. I signed on to a letter detailing the importance of including liability provisions in the healthcare transformation bill because I saw the opportunity and the need to secure meaningful reform this session. I voted for the Dash 7s in Ways and Means based on my commitment to meaningful medical malpractice reform. At the time, I thought the Dash 7s could achieve some degree of that reform. However, after a recent review, including an analysis by the Department of Justice and a legal review by OHSU, there remain significant questions about the legality of the recently proposed medical liability reform amendments. I am also concerned about the vulnerability of OHSU under the proposals. DOJ's memo, which I have made available earlier this morning to all of you, highlights that there are constitutional provisions that create uncertainty about the amendments. A significant issue is DOJ's concern about expanding tort claims coverage for non-publicly funded services. DOJ's memo goes on to say, and I quote, it would take time to evaluate the necessary structure that would satisfy the legal requirements and minimize the constitutional concerns associated with the current proposed amendments. In addition, you also should have a copy of the memo to me from OHSU, which raises several important concerns, including undoing carefully crafted agreements among multiple stakeholders. It is now clear to me that we need the time during the interim to fully develop and evaluate a medical liability reform proposal that satisfies legal requirements, minimizes constitutional concerns, and does not jeopardize current institutions like OHSU. I will support this bill today with the belief that the governor meant what he said in his February 2nd letter, but this body must hold him and ourselves accountable for real medical liability reforms in 2013.
Recognize Senator Fred G. Rod.
Thank you, Mr. President. You know I love you. colleagues, I think you should look at the walls around here. Look at the great names that are here. We talked to and we honored Mark Hatfield, who sat in this chamber. I'd like to say this chamber is a heck of a lot better than this bill, and it deserves better, and we deserve better, and we can do better. First of all, this is being done in a short session. This is a monumental bill in a short session, which, if I remember correctly, the short session was designed to tweak housekeeping bills and balance the budget. We needed to come here to do that, and we decided through the electorate to do just that very thing. I don't think the electorate wanted us to do a monumental bill in 28 days. We honored Mark Hatfield. I'd like to tell you, I have another mentor, and that mentor is Adam Smith. Adam Smith is the father of modern day economics. This is a supply demand curve problem. It truly is. What is the failure that we have in our current healthcare system? The consumer has no reason not to consume. The supplier has no reason not to supply. What's going to happen? There's a market failure. That market failure is what drives price up. There is a fix for that. It's called competition. And what we could do, and would work very well, is co-pays or medical IRAs, and that would solve the problem. It'd make people shop. It's a far simpler solution and does not cost the state a darn dime.
So we have not investigated the other solutions that were offered on the table, but instead we've come to the one-payer system. And what happens is now we're going to increase consumption or demand. We're not changing supply, but somebody's drawn a line across the top and say, hey, this is the cap, this is what we're paying, and this is what you're getting. What's going to happen according to Adam Smith? This is just common economics. What's going to happen? Shortages, just like Senator Whitted said. It's rationed care, so you are going to get shortages. Colleagues, I'm the only person here that worked in the Canadian healthcare system. I worked in it and around it. I was a dentist up there, and a lot of it was covered in the Canadian healthcare system. Canada is a beautiful country, but it has a lot of things to offer that we don't have. First of all, I'd like to point out that they are really endowed with a lot of natural resources, and unlike the state of Oregon, they actually make use of those natural resources. Number two, they have no military. Nigeria could take Canada out. Canada depends on the United States for their military. And the third thing that they have is they have major, and I do underline major, tort reform in Canada. My malpractice insurance when I was in Canada was less than $100. Now that tells you the importance of tort reform on a single payer system. So let's talk about the numbers. Now this is, how do you sell a program that's just flat out not going to work and violates everything Adam Smith teaches us in economics? First of all, you say it's going to save one heck of a lot of money. And we have a governor that's gone out and said, we're going to save $239 million. But not one dime's worth of savings came out in Ways and Means. The question was directly asked, show us where the savings are, and there wasn't a darn dime. And the reason there wasn't a darn dime is because it's going to create even a bigger market failure. So what's going to fix this system and make it work? $500 million is going to fall from the sky. And we are going to be obligated for the rest of Oregon's, you know, over the next biennium or two or three, to maintain what the federal government is telling us that they're going to do, and that is Obamacare. It will not work. It is going to fail. So because it doesn't match economically what we need to do, and the fact that we're not putting tort reform in, and everyone in this building knows where this bill is going to go. If we're going to have tort reform in the Senate, we know where that bill is going to go, and we know it's going to be watered down to the point that the trial lawyers are going to be happy with it. And let me tell you, there is going to be absolutely no tort reform in that bill of substance. None. De nada. So, colleague, I'd like to close by just saying something very simple. And that is, the last thing we need in healthcare is more government. Vote no.
Senator George yielded his time. Recognize Senator Ted Farrioli, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I rise in opposition of the bill. I just want to make something really clear. The reason we're not getting tort reform in this bill is because trial lawyers don't want tort reform. Should be clear to everyone. That shouldn't come as an informational thunderbolt to anyone. Trial lawyers never want tort reform. And anyone who thinks trial lawyers do or will want tort reform by 2013 is delusional. Mr. President, we talk about defensive medicine, but we don't explain what it is. It's the long waits in doctor's offices. While that second set of x-rays, or the CT scan, or the MRI is conducted for routine medical procedures. It's that extra consultation. It's the repeat visit. It's the additional services that add nothing to palliative care for the patient, but cost. That's defensive medicine. My dear colleagues, in 2009, we were called upon to save Oregon Health Sciences University. A crafty trial lawyer cracked the liability code and got a huge judgment against Oregon Health Sciences University. And the good doctors and administrators from OHSU came to the Capitol building and begged us to protect them from unlimited liability, which would mean the end of risky treatments where no other medical facility in the state will attempt those risky treatments. It means an end of experimental medicine and an end of teaching new techniques to new doctors because the liability is simply too great. And we acted. We saved the future of Oregon Health Sciences University. How? With the Dash Sevens. The same language that you rejected today, some of you. Oregon's facing a medical crisis today, and it isn't a fiscal crisis, that's another issue. Here's the medical crisis. We're only graduating about a third of the doctors we need to replace the doctors who are retiring from their own practices. That means that we'll need to recruit two-thirds of the future doctors and medical corps to serve Oregonians. Now, how are we going to recruit those doctors to a state that features the highest marginal rate of personal taxation, high insurance premiums, and no protection from unlimited liability? And why would a doctor go into practice or move his practice into a community care organization that features mostly Medicare, Medicaid, and Oregon plan patients when they reimburse at less than cost for those services and there's unlimited liability? Less than cost for the services, no limit to the liability. How will you recruit doctors into a CCO, given that equation? Colleagues, we heard about the money. The interesting part about the money is that the money is supposed to come from an increased set of definitions for what is reimbursable and increased amounts for those that are defined as reimbursable. So the money isn't $500 million as promised. It's a few dollars here, and a few dollars there, and a few dollars for services rendered and billings that might be argued about or contested. And over a one-year period, that's going to aggregate to $500 million. No guarantee, nothing in writing, an aggregation of promises, just like the aggregation of promises that we'll someday take up tort reform. Mr. President, this is not a good bill to pass in its current form. It is not a good bill to pass without some limitation of liability. It's not a good bill to pass with the unknowables. It's not a good bill to pass when we are looking at basing a balanced budget on this bill. Mr. President, I will be a no. Thank you.
Thank you. And the Senator Brian Boquist yielded his time. Are there any other members of the Senate who wish to speak on the Senate Bill 1580? Senator Elizabeth Steiner Haywood, do you wish to close, please?
Thank you, Mr. President. Colleagues, as the most junior member of this body, I'm not the most familiar with our policies and procedures. I am, however, intimately familiar with the intent of this bill, and it's one that I've been working toward personally for all of my career in medicine. Outside of this building, I am president of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, and no, this is not a conflict of interest, because the OAFP has spent the past 10 years in this building advocating for our patients, for your and my constituents. I see every day how broken healthcare is in our state and our nation. We do not have a healthcare system. We are not providing health. We are providing a patchwork of services that are equivalent to putting our finger in the proverbial dike. Our nation spends more per capita on healthcare than any other nation in the world by several multiples. And yet, many in our nation and our state receive no health care at all until a crisis arises. And our overall outcomes on health indicators are at best 40th among industrialized nations in the world. Senate Bill 1580 is another step down Oregon's bold path toward developing a true healthcare system that will promote health, intervene early when we can make a difference in managing chronic disease, truly integrate physical, mental, and oral health alongside social services for our most vulnerable Oregonians, and take us closer to the day when every Oregonian has access to high-quality, affordable health care. It is a well-designed bill that addresses concerns from every corner of the health care world. It provides solid structural guidelines for the, for the development of the CCOs while still allowing for significant community involvement in their design, recognizing their individual needs. Personally, I look forward to the day when I and my family, with our insurance through PEB, will receive our care through a CCO. Further, this bill provides the mechanism for Oregon to receive critical funding from the federal government to support our efforts to transform healthcare in our state. This funding will allow us to expand the roles of the Oregon Health Plan and to provide services such as coordinated physical and mental health care alongside with necessary social services that will enable OHP recipients and soon others to be active partners in their own health care. As others have said, this is not a perfect bill. I'm not sure a perfect bill exists. Several concerns have been raised, and I'd like to address two in particular. The first is liability reform. Some of our colleagues believe strongly that this bill should not pass if it does not contain specific language affecting liability reform. As she described, our colleague, Senator Johnson, who had been strongly supportive of this position, did all of us the favor of getting legal opinions from both the Department of Justice and OHSU that show that including this in the ways proposed would not only not accomplish the stated goals, but would in fact undermine the protections afforded OHSU and its physicians. I'm very grateful for her diligence in exploring this issue and getting us such an authoritative response. No matter how critical liability reform is, we cannot afford to move blindly forward in this direction without awareness of these consequences and others as yet unknown. As my colleague Dr. Bates said, he and I are probably more aware of the need for liability reform than any other legislator in this building. Every week, we hear from colleagues across our state who are leaving practice or limiting their scope of practice because liability insurance premiums are too high. We hear that women in rural Oregon are having to drive 50 to 100 miles just to deliver their babies because physicians in their communities with a heavy heart gave up providing maternity care. And yet, he and I have the privilege of co-carrying this bill and urging your aye vote. This bill does provide for a solid next step toward meaningful liability reform, reform that will include multiple components that will all contribute toward a climate that promotes patient safety, provides timely, appropriate care and compensation for those harmed by true negligence, and allows physicians to practice evidence-based medicine rather than defensive medicine, while providing necessary health services to people in their communities. I, like so many of you, have heard from dozens of physician colleagues about the need for tort reform. However, the vast majority have made it clear that the transformative effect of SB 1580 on their ability to practice medicine in the way they hoped to when they entered this profession far outweighs the need for tort reform at this time. The second major concern relates to economics. My colleague Evan Salino gave testimony in the Senate Committee on Healthcare, Human Services, and Rural Health Services about this very issue. He recounted the story of his patient John, a paraplegic man who required a shower chair to bathe independently. John's shower chair broke, and Dr. Salino put in a request to his insurer for a replacement. This request, for a $57 piece of equipment, was denied. John sustained a cut on the back of his leg from the broken shower chair. Because he has no feeling below his waist, he didn't know he had a cut until it became seriously infected. John ended up in the hospital, near death, with overwhelming sepsis. Over the past 2 years, he has undergone 8 separate surgical procedures, including a colostomy, and spent approximately 6 months in the hospital for a cost to date of over $2 million. None of this would have happened had John been cared for through a CCO. $2 million or $57? In summary, Senate Bill 1580 is the logical sequel to House Bill 2009 and House Bill 3650. Without it, all the work that has been done in this body over the past decade and more will be for naught. Without it, healthcare costs will continue to spiral out of control, further damaging our economy and taking money from other critical services such as education and public safety. Without it, Oregonians will continue to receive suboptimal healthcare. With it, Oregonians will have an incredible opportunity to move towards true personal and community health. With it, Oregon will once again take the lead in transforming healthcare delivery. I urge your aye vote on Senate Bill 1580. Thank you.
Upon the third reading and the final passage of Senate Bill 1580, those of the opinion that the bill should pass will answer aye as their names are called. And those opposed, no. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Boquist?
No.
Burdick?
Aye.
Devlin?
Aye.
Dingfelder?
Aye.
Edwards?
Aye.
Ferrioli?
No.
George?
No.
Gerard?
No.
Haas?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Cruz? Monis Anderson?
Aye.
Monroe?
Aye.
Morse?
No.
Nelson?
No.
Olson?
No.
Brzozinski?
Aye.
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Shields?
Aye.
Starr?
No.
Steiner Hayward?
Aye.
Telfer?
No.
Thompson?
No.
Berger?
Aye.
Whitsitt?
No.
Winters?
No.
Atkinson?
No.
Bates?
Aye.
Beyer?
Aye.
President Courtney?
Yes.
Voting no, Atkinson, Boquist, Ferrioli, George, Gerard, Cruz, Morse, Nelson, Olson, Starr, Telfer, Thompson, Whitsitt, Winters, 16 aye votes.
Senate Bill 1580, having received a constitutional majority, has been declared passed. Recognize Senator Brian Boquist, please, for what purpose do you rise?
Vote explanation, Mr. President.
Please file your vote explanation.
Thank you, Mr. President. I know we need health care reform, but I was still a no vote. The reason I was a no vote is I had 5 quick budget questions that were never answered. Last session, we had a $650 million hole we needed to plug. Nobody ever explained it. Beginning of this one, we had a $300 million hole. No one explained it. Today, we heard there's a $700 million hole. No one explained it. We heard there's $500 million check in the mail from Washington, D.C. No one explained it. And in the end, there's $253 million in existing organizations that someone's going to profit from, not the public, and where is that money going?
Recognize Senator Jackie Winters, please.
Explanation, please, Mr. President.
Please file your vote explanation.
While I have been a very strong supporter of health transformation and health reform, have worked in these chambers since probably 2001, have led the discussion on reform, we still have not got all the pieces together. I'm still bothered that we did not address the whole issue of tort reform. And I asked myself the question, if not now, when?
Ted.
So I just needed to put that on record. I totally support the direction. We do need reform. But I would just impress on us, let's get it right.
Okay, now recognize Senator Jeff Cruz, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that Senate Bill 1536 be withdrawn from the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Senator Jeff Cruz has moved that the Senate Bill 1536 be withdrawn from the Judiciary Committee. Would to your motion, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, Senate Bill 1536 was the standalone tort reform bill Mr. President, I think we should withdraw from committee, have one more chance to do the right thing, and our chance resides in actually bringing this bill to the floor and passing it now.
My fellow senators, there's a motion to withdraw. It is now on the floor. The motion is debatable. Is there anyone else just to speak, would like to speak on the motion to withdraw that has been made by Senator Jeff Cruz? Recognize Senator Ted Farioli, please.
Mr. President, I rise in support of the motion. I just will point out to members from both sides of the aisle, today, February 14th, 2012, you will be asked three times to help protect doctors from frivolous lawsuits by moving on a tort reform during this legislative session. Three times today, we've had the opportunity to vote on this issue. Thank you, Mr. President.
Recognize Senator Floyd Pazansky, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, to the motion.
To the motion.
I stand as the chair of the committee in opposition to the motion. I spoke to the maker of the motion as to whether he wanted to schedule his bill for a hearing. He said he did not. We had an opportunity to take it up in the course at the time in committee. He decided he didn't want it, and that's why it did not move forward. So at this point, I oppose that motion since he failed to follow through the procedure of using the committee process where these bills should, in fact, be debated. Thank you, Mr. President.
Further discussion on the motion is now before us. Senator Cruz, do you have any closing remarks?
Yes, thank you, Mr. President. As a correction, I was indeed offered a hearing on the bill, but was also told it would not move, so the purpose would have been moot. Just to be clear, what this bill states is that coordinated care organizations would be public entities specifically for the purposes of the Oregon Tort Claims Act, and that providers who are members of coordinated care organizations would
Senator,
be covered
Senator,
under that
Senator,
Oregon Tort
Senator,
Claims Act.
Thanks. All right. Senator Pazansky, I understand. Senator Pazansky, what purposes?
Maker of the motion is speaking out turns as to what is allowed under the rules for the motion.
Let us now proceed to the vote. Those who are of the opinion the motion should succeed and be successful, will you please answer aye as the motion, your names are called, and those opposed, no. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Burdick? Devlin? Dingfelder? Edwards? Farioli? George? Gerard? Hass? Johnson? Cruz? Montes Anderson? Monroe? Morse? Nelson? Olson? Brzezinski? Rosenbaum? Shields? Starr? Steiner Hayward? Telfer? Thompson? Berger? Whitsitt? Winters? Atkinson? Atkinson? Bates? Beyer? Boquist?
Aye.
President Courtney?
He's a no.
Not answering. Atkinson? Excused?
I don't know.
Okay. Excused. Senator Atkinson? Voting no. Bates? Beyer? Burdick? Devlin? Dingfelder? Edwards? Hass? Johnson? Montes Anderson? Monroe? Brzezinski? Rosenbaum? Shields? Steiner Hayward? Berger? 13 aye votes.
The motion has failed. Action on executive appointments requiring Senate confirmation. Introduction and first reading of Senate measures. The second reading of Senate measures, please.
Senate Bill 1518, relating to public contracting by state contracting agencies and declaring emergency. Senate Bill 1548, relating to advertising jobs for job vacancies and declaring emergency. Senate Bill 1555, relating to hostile education environments and prescribing effective date.
These are passed to the calendar. The third reading of Senate measures. Without objection, I will carry over the third reading of Senate measures until tomorrow's calendar. Hearing none. The first reading of House measures.
House Bill 4013, relating to accelerated college credit programs, prescribing effective date. House Bill 4015, relating to lead. House Bill 4035, relating to secure transactions and personal property, and declare emergency. House Bill 4046, relating to exemptions from assessments on gross amounts, premiums, and prescribing effective date. House Bill 4068, relating to food banks, and declare emergency. House Bill 4092, relating to distillery special events, and declaring emergency.
That's been to the President's desk for referral. Second reading of House measures. Third reading of House measures of the Business Center, according to SR 8.403, committee referral list number 11, was distributed to members Friday, February 13th. Referrals recorded the Journal Station report is so ordered. We're now on our announcements. Recognize Senator Jackie Winters.
Mr. Chair, unanimous consent to change my vote to aye on 1587.
Senator Jackie Winters has moved for unanimous consent to change her vote to aye on Senate Bill 1580. Are there?
It will not change the outcome.
It will not change the outcome. Are there any objections? Hearing none. How do you vote, Senator?
Aye.
Senator Winters has voted aye on Senate Bill 1580. Recognize Senator Jackie Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. President. I just would like to announce that the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will begin at 1, promptly at 1:10. Thank you.
Are there any other announcements? Senator Dianne Rosenbaum, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senate Democrats, in honor of Valentine's Day and Statehood Day, we will not caucus today. No caucus.
Recognize Senator Ted Ferrioli, please.
No caucus today, Mr. President. Thank you.
Thank you. If there are no other announcements, without objection, the Senate will be adjourned until 10:30 tomorrow, which is Wednesday, February 15th. Thank you for your indulgence today. Happy Oregon's birthday, and happy Valentine's Day. This Senate is now adjourned.